Okay, thanks. Yeah, hello everyone. Welcome to the Quantum Manner seminar today. So today our speaker is John McGreevy, who is a professor in UC San Diego. So John has been doing lots of great work across different branches in quantum many-body physics in general. So today it is our great pleasure to have John to talk about some recent progress about integral bootstrap and some applications. So John, please take it away.
Thanks a lot, Peter. Thanks for having me. So the work I want to tell you about was spearheaded by our wonderful postdoc, Bowen Shi at UCSD, also involves my student, Jinlong. And one way to motivate what we're trying to do is the following question. So suppose somebody hands you a density matrix that lives on some extended collection of degrees of freedom spread over space, like in this picture, on a topologically trivial region, right? Like a ball. How do you extract from that density matrix the universal information encoded in the state? So maybe it's part of a ground state of some phase of matter. How do you extract from that density matrix the data that characterizes that phase of matter? So this is a pretty broad question, and I'm not going to approach the general version of it. A slightly less grand goal is, suppose that we know that the density matrix represents some liquid topologically ordered ground state, meaning that it represents some gapped phase of matter with some topology-dependent ground state degeneracy. And by liquid, I mean that ground state degeneracy doesn't depend on the geometry, but only on the topology. So it's not fractons. So suppose with this more limited assumption, we'd like to extract the universal information. And under these assumptions, we know that the universal information should be encoded in a topological quantum field theory. So the goal is to extract the data of that topological quantum field theory just from this density matrix on a ball. And there've been some partial successes in answering this question of extracting parts of that universal information. The most famous of which is the topological entanglement entropy, which gives the total quantum dimension of the anions in the case of 2+1 dimensions, and more generally some generalization of the total quantum dimension in higher dimensions. Much more recently, these folks, including Bowen, found an observable that you can compute just from the density matrix in a ball called the modular commutator that extracts the chiral central charge of a 2+1 dimensional phase of matter. So the number of chiral edge modes just from information about the entanglement Hamiltonian of various regions that are part of a ball. And that idea was recently generalized to a case with U1 symmetry, whereby a similar formula arises for the Hall conductance. And then more generally, this question is sort of the motivating question for a program called Entanglement Bootstrap, which I'll review and motivate in the next few slides, which so far has been very successful at extracting in two plus one dimensions, various data about the anion types, their quantum dimensions, their S matrix, their fusion rules. But suppose you want to extract, all of the topological quantum field theory information. An apparent obstacle to doing that is that, the way we usually think about topological field theory is it's a machine whose input is some interesting manifold, like some, interesting topological space, and whose output is some invariant, right? For each topological manifold, you put the field theory on it, it produces some topological invariant. And so how could we possibly access the data about the field theory on some complicated curved space just from a single state on a ball? So that's an obstacle that I'll call frowny face. So maybe just to motivate a little bit more what we're trying to do, the kinds of questions that we're hoping to answer are the following. So in 2+1 dimensions, we have a very good idea of what the data of the topological field theory is. There's some kind of modular tensor category, which there's some huge mathematical machinery for understanding those things. But in other dimensions, actually, the problem is much more wide open for what is the framework for understanding liquid topological order. So in particular, do we even know what all the invariants are? Are there new excitation types? And can we understand their structure from minimal assumptions? And then a second point of view, which motivates what we're trying to do, is that a phase of matter with topological order, when you put it on some space, it's a probe of the topology of the space it's living on. And in particular, the universal data about the ground state on that space is some topological invariant of that space, like the number of ground states on a, you know, some manifold is an example of a topological invariant. And so I think it's pretty interesting to ask, how does that data associated with putting topological orders on some manifold, how does it relate to known invariants, known you know, the ones the mathematicians study? Okay, so there's lots of related work. I've quoted here some papers that are about the higher dimensional topological field theory. But most of that work starts from axioms of topological field theory and then tries to classify them. Here we're going to start from a very different starting point. So here are my goals for this talk. I want to try to introduce entanglement bootstrap, which is if you like, you know, one goal of the entanglement bootstrap is to derive those axioms of topological field theory from the kind of starting point that I advocated. And then the most important thing I want to try to convey is I want to explain a method to overcome obstacle frowny face. That is, how do you study non-trivial manifolds starting just from a density matrix on a ball? And this is the way that we're going to do that is a sort of quantum avatar of what's known as Kirby's torus trick in the topology literature that I'll review a bit. And then as an application of that method, we'll use this understanding to understand a general notion of braiding non-degeneracy. So in 2+1 dimensions, the name modular tensor category to describe the topological field theory governing the anions in 2+1 dimensions, the word modular refers to the fact that there's an S matrix, which is a pairing between anions, which is unitary. So somehow the word modular means unitary. So that statement is an assumption of topological field theory, which can be proved from the entanglement bootstrap. And moreover, it can be generalized to a large class of different kinds of topological excitations in different dimensions, sometimes with boundary. So that's the idea. For a big class of excitations, we'll define what we'll call a pairing matrix, which is unitary, and it's associated with an auxiliary closed manifold that we'll build by this method that I described earlier. And in the case of anions in 2+1 dimensions, this matrix is the S matrix and the manifold is the 2 torus. Okay, and so this turns out to be a pretty fruitful concept. In particular, it lets us count excitations, it gives us some new insights into topological entanglement entropy, and it leads to some generalizations of the Verlinde formula. Okay, and one surprise, and the reason that I don't call it the S matrix in general, is that in general there's no relation to the mapping class group of this pairing manifold like there is in 2 dimensions in the case of the torus. Okay, all right. So an important question that I didn't answer in that brief motivation for topological bootstrap is, if I hand you a density matrix, how do you know whether it represents some liquid topologically ordered ground state? And in this work by Bowen and Isaac Kim and Kato, which I should say really, really began this whole program, they identified 2 axioms about the structure of entanglement in the state, which are really a beautiful encoding of this fact, of the fact that the ground state is a liquid topologically ordered ground state. And okay, so there are 2 axioms, and the axioms are that for any collection of regions with this topology, so a disk surrounded by its thickened boundary, this combination of their entropies should vanish. And similarly, for this combination, for a disk with its thickened boundary cut into 2 parts, this combination of entropies should vanish. And the way you should think about B here, B stands for buffer. B is a buffer between the interior C and the rest of the world. And so these are the assumptions. And let me make some comments about those assumptions. So the first assumption, axiom 0, is actually a very strong one because it implies that the mutual information between C and any region A outside actually vanishes. So in particular, it means that the correlation length is it means it's very small. And A1 similarly implies that the conditional mutual information between C and any reason outside conditioned on B vanishes, so that the state is a quantum Markov chain. And that that's actually a very powerful assumption, and the machinery of quantum Markov chains is the basic tool that we'll use. So let me make a disclaimer. These assumptions are actually too strong. Not every wave function representing some topological ordered liquid phase of matter has zero correlation length. Rather, zero correlation length is a property of fixed points, right? Special points in the phase diagram that are fixed points of the normalization group. So the expectation is that if you start with some random point in the phase diagram where the correlation length is finite, the axioms will be violated. So that instead of being zero, this will be small. But as I take larger and larger regions, I could do some renormalization group transformation and get closer to the fixed point, the axioms will become more and more approximately true. So there's a expectation that there's a generalization of the story, which is a robust version where instead of assuming that this is zero, I assume that it's small. That hasn't been built yet. Okay. And so these axioms, roughly you should think of them as implying the area law. One way to see that A0 implies the area law is it says that the entropy of C is bounded above by the entropy of B, where B is its thickened boundary. So if I make C really big and B is some narrow little thing, the entropy of the whole ball is bounded above by the entropy of its boundary, which is manifestly an area law. And then A1 says that you can deform the shape of the region. So it's not just true for balls. It's not just true for round balls. It's true for arbitrary shaped balls. Okay. So those are the assumptions. The basic object of study in this program is called the information convex set. And the information convex set is a device that associates to any region of space, so say an annulus X here, that's part of the ball in which the density matrix lives. It associates to it a convex set of density matrices, which is called sigma of X, the information convex set. And which density matrix is it? It's density matrices living on the region X, with the property that locally they look like the ground state, they look like the reference state. And by locally, I mean if you draw any ball, like one of these balls here, inside the region and compare the reference state and the state in question, they should agree. Okay, so this is the condition. So elements of the information convex set look like the ground state in the region in question, but outside the region, they could do something else. So in particular, here's an annulus, a state in the information convex set. Well, it could be just the global ground state, the ground state that we started, but it could be a state obtained by acting on the ground state with a string operator like this one, which creates an anion inside the hole of the annulus. So inside the hole of the annulus, it's not no longer the ground state, but the string operator is such that it's deformable. You get the same state whether the string is there or whether it's here or whether it's somewhere else. And so for any ball inside the annulus, you can't tell the difference from the ground state. And so this is some intuition for why the information convex set has something to do with the anion types. And moreover, this information convex set is a topological invariant in several senses. Well, first of all, it's unchanged if you make some smooth deformation of the region X. So the information convex set of a round annulus is the same as the information convex set of this amoeba with a single hole. That's called the isomorphism theorem, and that follows from the axioms. Secondly, it should be insensitive to small changes of the reference state within the phase. So that's a proof of that statement requires this robust version of the axioms, which doesn't exist yet. Okay, when I say the two convex sets are the same, two convex sets of density matrices are the same, what I mean is that the entropy differences are preserved by the deformation and fidelities are preserved. So it's more structured than just the information, just the data as a convex set. It's the structure of the density matrices that's preserved. Okay. And so the idea is that the data of these convex sets for various choices of regions is a way to extract the universal data from this given density matrix on a ball. Okay, so this information convex set is some finite dimensional compact convex set, and such a set is specified by its extreme points. And they basically come in two types. It could be a simplex, where the corners of the simplex are isolated extreme points, or it could be something like the block ball, right? The set of density matrices on a qubit is also a convex set, but it has continuously connected extreme points, right? Which are the pure states. And we'll see both of these possibilities are realized for different choices of topology of the region X. Okay, so first of all, the first result is that the information convex set of a ball is just the reference state. There's just a single point. Okay, so there's nothing to say there. The second result is that the information convex set of an annulus is actually a simplex. So meaning that there are isolated extreme points that are orthogonal to each other. And those extreme points are in one-to-one correspondence with anion types. And the reason for this is essentially this picture that I described earlier, that you put the anion inside the hole and that produces an extreme point. Any density matrix that's not an extreme point is some convex combination of doing this with different types of anions. Okay, the third result is that the information convex set of the disk with two holes, each of the holes is associated with an anion type because there's a little annulus surrounding the boundary of the hole. And this produces fusion spaces. So some Hilbert space, some auxiliary Hilbert space, whose dimension is NABC, which can be interpreted as the fusion coefficient of the fusion rules of the anions. Okay, there's a formula for the quantum dimension, just in the quantum dimension of anion type, just from the entropy of the associated extreme point. And this definition of the quantum dimension agrees with what I guess is the usual definition in terms of the positive eigenvectors of the fusion rules. Okay, and then finally, you can extract the topological entanglement entropy as it's the entropy of the maximum entropy state, or it's the difference between the entropy of the minimum entropy state minus the maximum entropy state. Okay, so that was a very lightning summary of the work of Bowen and Isaac Kim in two dimensions. These axioms can be generalized to any dimension. Let me describe them in three dimensions. Essentially, they're the same. We consider a ball and its thickened boundary and demand that this combination of entropies vanish, and exactly the same thing for the second combination. And all of these basic results generalize. The information convex set is still invariant under deformations of the shape of the region. But now let's ask what generalizes the annulus for labeling excitations. And it's very interesting. There are many more kinds of excitations in three dimensions. So for example, there can be particle excitations. A particle is surrounded by a sphere shell. And so it's the information convex set of a sphere shell that detects particles. There can be loop excitations. The thing that surrounds a loop is a solid torus. The information convex set of the solid torus detects loop excitations. There are more general loop excitations which are detected by the torus shell. And actually, there are many new possibilities beyond this. So before I talk about the new possibilities, let me for definiteness mention a good example to keep in mind, a family of examples, which is just 3D gauge theory whose gauge group is some finite group. So there's a solvable limit of this model, which is the 3D quantum double model of Kataev, whose Hamiltonian is a sum of commuting projectors, where on each link, the Hilbert space is labeled by elements of the group. And this term imposes a sort of Gauss's law, and this term imposes that the flux wants to vanish, the flux through any plaquette wants to vanish. And in this model is actually extremely beautiful. It's really just a physical realization of group theory. The particle excitations are associated with irreducible representations of the group, and the loop excitations are associated with conjugacy classes of the group. And the reason that I know this is because the information convex set can be constructed very explicitly by studying just a model with just a few links and a few vertices. And the idea is essentially to use entanglement normalization. So start with whatever lattice you want, draw the region of interest, and then use entanglement normalization to reduce the complicated lattice inside the region to as few vertices as possible that are enough to just to triangulate the region. And so in this way, we can explicitly figure this out. So the information convex set, in at least in a solvable model, is a, you know, it's a very concrete thing that you can actually compute. Okay, so so that's a good example to keep in mind. So as I was saying, in three dimensions, there are many new examples. For example, starting with two loops, there are many ways to fuse them together. One is just to put them on top of each other, but another way is to fuse them together so that they share a little bit of an edge. And this leads to what you might call a graph excitation. The excitations with this topology are detected by the information convex set of a genus 2 handle body, right? So this genus 2 Riemann surface filled in. And you can see that this red excitation sort of links with it. This turns out also to be a simplex. And in the case of the quantum double, there are actually 11 extreme points of the information convex set of a genus 2 solid, which is different than 3 times 3. 3 is the number of extreme number of types of loops. Sorry, I'm talking about the case of S, when the group is S3. There are 3 kinds of loop excitations, but putting them together in this way gives 11 types of excitations. So it's not just two loops stuck on top of each other. Okay, there are many more generalizations. So for any knot or link that you can draw, you can consider an excitation with that topology, which is detected by its complement in, say, in the 3 sphere. And there can also be excitations which are sort of clusters of loops and particles attached together, which are detected by regions like the torus minus the ball that I've drawn here. Okay, so I have to, one very important thing I have to say is that the information convex set of a region contains 2 kinds of data, right? Which are related to these 2 kinds of convex sets, the simplices and block balls, and which let's call them classical and quantum, corresponding to those 2 cases. So, and there's a very simple topological criterion on a region to decide whether or not its information convex set contains quantum information. And so if the region is what's called sectorizable, then it contains only classical information. And it's really a very physical condition. So a region is sectorizable if it can be divided up into 2 parts, like this, L and R, which are disjoint, both of which can be extended, both of which can be deformed back to the whole region. If you can do this, if you can divide the region in half, and like one of these flatworms that can, you cut it in half and it forms, each part forms the whole. If you can do that, it means that you've copied the information, because the information convex set is invariant under that deformation of growing the new worm. And famously, quantum information cannot be copied, right? Unknown quantum information can't be copied. Only classical information can be copied. And so maybe it's not too surprising that if a region is sectorizable, then you can prove that its information convex set is a simplex. So it has isolated orthogonal extreme points labeled by, you can think of them as labeling independent excitations. So the annulus is sectorizable. The genus G handle body is sectorizable. Those are some examples that I've talked about already. Okay, I'm going to skip the proof of that statement. If a region is not sectorizable, like the ball minus 2 balls or the disk minus 2 holes, then it actually encodes a fusion space. It actually encodes non-trivial quantum information. And here's the idea. So Bowen and collaborators proved this structure theorem about the structure of the information convex set of a general region. And the idea is, first consider, so given some region, consider its thickened boundary. Right, here's just draw the boundary of the region and thicken it into a region of the right of the full dimension. The thickened boundary of a region is always sectorizable. And so its information convex set is always a simplex. So let's call A the set of labels on extreme points of this thickened bound of the information convex set of the thickened boundary. The statement is that the information convex set of the whole region is a convex hull. That's what I mean by this plus sign, over possible sectors of the thickened boundary. And then for each sectors of the thickened boundary, so if I specify like A, B, C as the states of these annuli on the boundary of this annulus of this two-hole disk, for each sector, there's a convex set, which is the state space of some Hilbert space. So VA of omega is some Hilbert space labeled by A, the data of the thickened boundary. And the information convex set of with those boundary conditions is the set of density matrices on that Hilbert space, like the block ball of that Hilbert space. And the dimension of this Hilbert space is an invariant. It's some topological invariant of the region determined by the topological order. Okay, which in the case of the two-hole disk, we interpret as the fusion coefficients. non-negative integer. Yeah, so for example, for the ball minus two balls in three dimensions, the boundaries label particle excitations, and which in the case of the quantum double are labeled by irreducible representations of G. And so maybe you can guess that the fusion dimensions in this case are related to the structure constants for the fusion of irreducible representations, right? If I multiply A times B, I get a direct sum of irreducible representations. I get NABC times representation C. Okay, so that's what happens in that example. Okay, how am I doing on time? All right, so yeah, so I want to try to give a decent introduction to the idea of entanglement bootstrap, and then we'll see how much time we have left for the application that I'm interested in today. So a key tool in proving all these things is this notion of merging. The idea is, and I guess it's maybe not too surprising that if we have a state on one region and a state on another region, if they agree on the overlap of the two regions, then it's in general, this is a hard problem in quantum information theory. When can you solve this quantum marginal problem? But under the assumptions of entanglement bootstrap, it's actually very easy. And in fact, the result is as good as it can be. So given a state in the information convex set of AB and a state in the information convex set of BC, they can be merged. Maybe there is some assumption about the overlap, but they can be merged into a state on the information convex set of ABC. That's the idea. And moreover, the merging process preserves the entropy differences. And the result is a quantum Markov chain, which means that it's the maximum entropy state with the given marginals. Okay, and this merging has all kinds of applications. One is the proof of this isomorphism theorem that I advertised. I'm gonna skip the proof. Another is what we call the associativity theorem, which is that if I merge the two regions over a whole boundary component, so like in this picture, so AB is this yellow thing and BC is this blue thing, so they share this whole boundary component, then the fusion dimensions add by this convolution procedure. And we call this the associativity theorem because in the case of particles in two dimensions, this implies that the fusion dimensions of the ball minus three holes, or the disk minus three holes, is the multiplication of the fusion coefficients is associative, right? It's this times this is equal to this times this. It doesn't matter in which order you fuse them together. Okay. All right, so let me give a preview of what I mean by this remote detectability in general. This principle of, it's sometimes called remote detectability, or sometimes it's called Brady non-degeneracy, or in two plus one dimensions, it's called modularity. It's the idea that every anion or every topological excitation should braid non-trivially with something else. All right, so for example, in the case of 3 plus 1 dimensions, here's a particle. A particle in three plus one dimensions doesn't braid with a particle, it braids with a loop, right? You see this particle, goes through the loop, and their trajectories cannot be disentangled in space-time. And this is an axiom. So, right, and the idea is that you pick up some non-trivial phase as a result of doing this adiabatically. And this is an axiom of other approaches to topological field theory. And, the motivation for it is, well, if there were no other thing with which it had some statistical phase, well, it wouldn't really be an anion. That's kind of the idea. But this is something that can be proved from our starting point. So in the case of the 3D quantum double, we saw that the number of particle types are associated with irreducible representations of G, and loops are associated with conjugacy classes of G. And famously, the number of those things is the same for a finite group. And so that says that there's some square matrix associated with this braiding. That's a good sign. But more generally, we can prove from the bootstrap axioms that we can construct an S matrix. This is not the construction that I'm going to use in the rest of the talk, but there is a construction like this, which associates an extreme point of the solid torus with a particle excitation with an operator that transports a particle around the solid torus. And this matrix is not only square, but it's unitary. And in the special case of the quantum double, maybe you can already guess what it is. So using this minimal diagram idea, where we reduce to just a minimal number of edges and vertices, we can very explicitly construct these things with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So the trans transportation operator is this, an extreme point is this. So chi A is the character of this representation A. C alpha is the conjugacy class of this element alpha. And it's pretty easy to see how to pair these things together. The S matrix in this case is just the character table properly normalized so that it's a unitary matrix. So actually this proof that I advertised of the unitarity of this object, it gives an independent proof of the orthogonality relations for the characters of a finite group. It's not the most efficient way to prove that, but yeah, it's one way to do it. Okay. All right, so now let me talk about the sort of bigger picture of this generalization of this notion of gradient non-degeneracy. And the key idea is what we might call manifold completion. And Bowen came up with this metaphor that I really like, that the density matrix on the ball that we're starting with is like a seed, which contains all of the genetic information about the state of matter that it describes. And the process that I'm going to tell you about is like growing the plant from the seed, right? Where the plant is like the complicated manifold that you put the state on. Okay. So that this process has two steps. The first step is this notion of immersion. So I said earlier that we could define the information convex set for an arbitrary region, which was part of the ball in which the reference state was defined. But actually, it's not necessary that that region is a subregion of the ball. So for example, here's a picture of, so this part of the object here is covered twice, right? So I'm gonna call this region immersed. It's immersed in, you know, in, there's a differential topology definition of immersion, which is some map from some space into some other space with the property that it's tangent space at each point in the domain is non-degenerate. Right, so we don't actually have that. We don't actually need to do calculus, but the idea is that in the neighborhood of each point, you can draw a ball in the region. In the neighborhood of each point in the domain, you can draw a ball. And that means that we can compare a density matrix on this region with the density matrix on the ball. Right, if I draw a ball here, I have two density, there's the density matrix on W and the density matrix on the ball, on the big ball. And so, the idea is, so this is a generalization of what's called the Kirby-Torres trick, which is given an immersion from some d-dimensional manifold into a d-dimensional ball, we can pull back structure from the ball to the manifold W. So, you know, for example, given some function on the ball, we can pull back the function to the function of its image, of, you know, the function on a point in W is the function of its image. And so Kirby uses this to communicate smooth structure between the ball and the torus, or piecewise linear structure maybe. Recently, a similar version of this trick was used by Hastings to pull back data about invertible local Hamiltonians of invertible phases and also quantum cellular automata. And here we're gonna use the same idea to pull back the reference state, this reference state that we're starting with on small balls. Okay, so a few comments. So if I draw some general immersed region, it's not obvious that its information convex set is non-empty, and it's not obvious that it contains anything like a vacuum state, but this isomorphism theorem generalizes. So as long as two regions are related by a family of immersions, a continuous family of immersions, this is called a regular homotopy, then their information convex sets are isomorphic. Okay. So that was step one. And step two is to fill in the holes. So this region that I drew on the previous slide, think about what its topology is. Well, it's a thing that has two handles and it has a single boundary, right? If you follow this boundary, it just has a single connected component, right? And actually it's a torus with one hole, right? It's the same. So if I draw a torus as identify two opposite sides of a square, and make a hole in it somewhere. This thing is just a single hole, right? And so, yeah, it's just a torus with one hole. And the key idea is that if we put the boundary of this region in a sector with quantum dimension one, it's possible to fill in the hole, to heal the puncture, and thereby make a reference state on the full manifold, on the closed manifold. And this is something that we can do under some pretty broad assumptions. And so here's a bewildering collection of pictures of examples where we can do this procedure. So here's the example of the torus. That's an example where we can fill in the hole. Another example is the disk. If I have a disk, it has a single boundary. Actually, it's guaranteed to have the identity state on the boundary. And we can fill in the hole and make a sphere. The sphere is useful because then I can, I can use it to turn an annulus inside out by moving it over the North Pole. We can make a genus 2 Riemann surface. So those are all two-dimensional examples. We can also do three-dimensional examples. Here is a picture of S2 times S1 minus a ball. It's maybe not so obvious that that's what that is, but so if you take a sphere shell and connect it with a tube, connect the outside to the inside with a tube, you get S2 times S1 minus a ball. And that ball can be filled in to make the full space. We can make S2 times S1 connect sum with S2 times S1. Connect sum means you take two manifolds, cut out a ball, and then glue together the boundaries of those balls. And we can make examples with gap boundaries. So for example, we can make a cylinder with two gapped boundaries. There's a generalization of the entanglement bootstrap program to topological states with gapped boundaries. Okay, so in fact, so you might ask, well, which manifolds can we construct in this way? And I spent a long time trying to figure out which manifolds have the property that if you poke holes in them, if you puncture them, like the puncturing the torus here, you can immerse it in the ball. And conveniently for me, Mike Friedman and collaborators posted a paper, I guess it's 2 months ago now, which completely answered this question in three and four dimensions. And the answer is that the only obstruction to doing this is if the Stiefel-Whitney classes of the tangent bundle are non-zero. So if the manifold isn't orientable, we can't do it. Maybe that's not too surprising. And if the manifold doesn't admit a spin structure, we also can't do it. That one's a little more mysterious. But every closed 3D manifold can be constructed this way, in fact. Okay. All right, so this brings me to a special case of manifolds that we might like to construct, which are called pairing manifolds, which we're going to associate with this braiding non-degeneracy business. So here's a very sketchy version of what turns out to be a pretty technical definition that we've been refining over the last, I don't know how long. The idea is that a pairing manifold is a closed, compact manifold, which can be cut in half in two complementary ways. So it can be divided into X and its complement, and it can be divided into Y and its complement. So like in this picture of the torus, so X and its complement and Y and its complement, in such a way that all of the intersections between X and Y, and X bar and Y and so on, are balls, right? You see X and Y here are each an annulus, but the intersection between them is just a ball. And the same must be true for X bar and Y bar and X and so on. And those intersections should be generic. If you deform it a little bit, it shouldn't suddenly change. And plus a few other assumptions that I'm not going to say explicitly, but I can if you want me to. So, but the idea of this most important assumption that the intersections are balls is that the information about the density matrix on X is completely invisible to the state on Y, right? Because an element of the information convex set of the ball is always just the reference state. So if the intersection is just a ball, you don't know anything about the topological data on X from the state on Y. And in fact, it means that a minimum entropy state of X is a state on the whole manifold, which is a minimum entropy state on X, cutting it along X, is a maximum entropy state of Y. Okay, and so recalling that the information convex set of each of X and Y, its point in life is to detect various classes of excitations, this relationship between X and Y is going to lead to a pairing between excitations. The excitations detected by X are going to be paired with the excitations detected by Y. Okay, so here's another example of a pairing manifold is the cylinder with two gapped boundaries. So it can be divided in half by cutting it vertically, into this sort of half annulus, which is the sectorizable region, or it can be divided in half by cutting it along the middle into this, I guess it's also two half annuli. It's two annuli which have one gapped boundary. And this region actually is not sectorizable. So this region contains quantum information. But somehow the excitations detected by this guy and the excitations detected by this guy are paired with each other. Okay, so a question that you might ask is, suppose I want to, suppose I know the region X, and I'm interested in finding out what is it paired with? What is the region Y? And so this slide, the intention of this slide is to try to give some intuition about that. So the claim is that given X, Y is homotopic to the union of two operators that create extreme points of X. So here, that sentence is best parsed with some examples. So here's an annulus. The extreme points of X are created by these open string operators. I can make a sort of closed string operator by pairing together two of these open string operators, right? Sort of cancel, this is A and this is A bar. I can cancel those excitations. And that string operator is homotopic to this annulus. The annulus Y is the region that's paired with the annulus X. Similarly, the solid torus detects excitations created by this membrane operator whose boundary is a closed loop. If I pair together two of those things, I get something with the same topology as a sphere shell. So the solid torus is paired with the sphere shell. The sphere shell detects particles. Two particles form a loop. The loop is homotopic to the solid torus. Okay, so the pairing is transitive. We know it's reflexive. The pairing is reflexive. Okay, here's a harder one. The torus minus a ball detects excitations which are a loop attached to a particle. If I take two of those, it combines together to make another torus minus a ball. So the torus minus a ball is actually it pairs with itself. And then here's the excitations for the cylinder with two gap boundaries. So this half annulus detects particles attached to the boundary. This half annulus detects particles whose open string can end at the boundary. And so each of those is, this X produces this Y, this X produces this Y. Okay, so that's some attempt to give intuition about what is X given Y and vice versa. And so I said that this definition was sort of restrictive and technical. So it was very important to us that we could make many examples that satisfy the definition. And so the point of this table is to demonstrate that there are many examples of manifolds that are pairing manifolds that satisfy this definition in various dimensions. And, sometimes with gap boundary, sometimes not with gap boundary. And in each case, it's a pairing between two sets of regions, which detects some kind of excitations. Okay. So having made this somewhat technical and restrictive definition, we should be able to learn something from it. So here's some things that we learned from it. One thing we learned is that the information convex, if X and Y participate in a pairing manifold, the information convex sets of X and X bar are isomorphic, and Y and Y bar and of Y and Y bar are isomorphic. Secondly, a sentence that we will learn to interpret as the pairing matrix is square is that there's a fusion space associated with the pairing manifold. The information convex set of the pairing manifold is the state space of some Hilbert space, V of M. And there are two ways of constructing a basis for that Hilbert space, one of which comes from Y and one of which comes from X. And so that says that these two numbers are equal. And one outcome of this fact is that we can count genus G graph excitations, like say loop excitations, for any G in terms of the fusion space dimension of the ball minus G ball. So I guess I didn't say this, but the genus G handle, if X is the genus G handle body that detects these graph excitations, the dual region Y is the ball minus G balls. And so it says the number of genus G graph excitations is equal to this combination of the fusion dimensions of the ball minus G balls. Which in the case of the 3D quantum double is some unfamiliar to me fact about characters and fusion of irreducible representations, which actually can be proved in other ways, perhaps unsurprisingly. A third consequence is that the topological entanglement entropy computed from X meaning divide X up into a bunch of regions, or maybe a better way to say it is compute the maximum, the difference between the maximum entropy state and the minimum entropy state of X of the information convex set, and do the same thing for Y. They have to agree. Okay. I think I already said this. So the main application of this technology is the construction of this thing we call the pairing matrix. And it's simplest to introduce in the case where both X and Y are sectorizable. So let's talk about that case first. In that case, there are two bases of states of the fusion space of M, one of which comes from extreme points of X, of sigma X, the other of which comes from extreme points of sigma Y. And they each form an orthonormal basis of this same Hilbert space. And so naturally there's a unitary matrix that takes one basis to the other. And that's the S matrix. That's the pairing matrix. In the case of the when M is just the two torus, it's the familiar S matrix. And why is it the S matrix? Well, it's because alpha X here, the states associated with that we made from extreme points of X, are minimally entangled states along X. And alpha and AY here are minimally entangled states along Y. And Tharoon and friends taught us long ago that that's a way to construct the S matrix by taking the overlap of two sets of minimally entangled states. Something that's ambiguous in what I've said so far is the phases of each of these basis states. And we can fix that using this uncertainty principle. The fact that one sub X is the maximum entropy state in terms of Y implies a certain non-degeneracy. That means that the first row and the first column, first row and first column of the S matrix are non-zero. And so we can choose the phases of the vectors to make them positive. Okay, so that completely specifies the S matrix in this case. In the case where either X or Y is not sectorizable, the story is a little more complicated. So now again, let's assume X is still sectorizable. So extreme points of X provide a basis for V of M. But now in order to make a state of the fusion space of M from a state of Y, we need actually two labels, right? Essentially, we need a state on V of Y and a state of V of Y bar. And so the state actually has three indices. One is the sector of the boundary of Y, which I'll call A, and then two indices in the fusion space of Y. And so the unitary matrix that takes one basis to the other has lots of labels coming off of it. It's an overlap between this state with one label and this state, which is like a matrix. Again, this matrix is manifestly unitary. And again, we can try to fix the phase ambiguity using the fact that the state one sub x is a maximally entangled state on Y. But actually, it's not possible to fix all the phases because there are necessarily some zeros. This kind of S matrix was studied before by Janet Hung and collaborators in the example of gap boundaries. Okay. So good, I'm doing okay on time. So there's one more important application of this technology that I want to share with you, which is about generalized symmetries. We can construct an algebra of symmetry operators just from this reference state. And the way it's defined is it's not defined by commuting with the Hamiltonian because we haven't said anything about a Hamiltonian, right? It's, you know, we just have this state. We don't necessarily know a parent Hamiltonian, but we can define what's called an algebra of flexible operators on an arbitrary region, which is essentially operators that play nicely with arbitrary elements of the information convex set. So for any subregion of, we demand that for any subregion of omega that you can get by removing ball. So essentially that means it's homotopic to the whole region. There's some operator supported just on that subregion, which has the property that acting on an arbitrary element of the information convex set agrees with the original operator. Okay, so that's a slightly complicated definition, but essentially it's some algebra of operators whose support is on the region, which you can move around. You can freely move around. And this actually is an algebra, given two of them, the product is also an element. And a basis of this algebra is provided by extreme points of the information convex set. And so notice these operators, they're symmetry operators in the sense that they act nicely on states that look like the ground state, but they don't need to be invertible, and they don't need to be supported on manifolds, right? They can be supported on some graph like this. So that's why I call it generalized symmetries, right? So just like non-invertible symmetry operators. So in the special case where the region Y participates in a pairing manifold, then actually there's a second basis of this algebra of flexible operators with the property that they create these minimally entangled states on X, the dual region. And these also generate the algebra of deformal operators on Y. And so we can write the algebra in terms of some set of structure constants of these operators, labeled by elements of the extreme points of the information convex set of the dual region. And by studying this matrix elements of these operators in a couple of different ways, we can relate those structure constants to the S matrix. So you can see that this is a generalization of the Verlinde formula with the slight subtlety that here this S matrix it has some extra indices coming off of it, and this traces over those extra indices. This kind of formula was first written down in that example I mentioned by Janet Hung. One thing you can see is that in the special case where Y has non-trivial fusion multiplicity, its operator algebra is not abelian. So this W alpha doesn't commute with W beta. F alpha beta is not equal to F beta alpha because of those extra indices. Similarly, there's a conjugate statement about flexible operators on X, and there's a second Verlinde formula relating those flexible operators to the S matrix, to the S matrix where we can track the other set of indices. Okay, now the Verlinde formula is usually a relationship between the S matrix and fusion coefficients, right? Something about fusion of representations. But only in some cases can we prove that the structure constants of this algebra, of the symmetry algebra, is related to these fusion coefficients, which in particular implies that they're non-negative integers. So more generally, we actually don't know whether that's true. Okay, so why don't I call this matrix the S matrix? Well, in two dimensions, it's called the S matrix because it's related to the operation on the torus that exchanges the one cycle with the other cycle. So I focused a lot on this example of where the pairing manifold is S2 times S1, that's associated with the braiding between particles and loops in 3+1 dimensions. So you can ask, what's the mapping class group of that manifold? Well, it turns out it's just Z2 times Z2. One of the Z2s just reverses the orientation of each factor, and the other one is a little more complicated. It's more like a Dane twist. And so as you move around the circle, you do a 2π rotation of the sphere. So I think that's likely more like the T matrix in 2+1 dimensions. It's the thing that detects the statistics of the excitations. And so in particular, no element of this group is associated with exchanging particles and loops, unsurprisingly. Only in cases where the pairing matrix is a pairing between the same kind of excitation in itself, like say S2 times S2 in 4 dimensions, which pairs loops with loops, only in that case is there an element of the mapping class group that is like the S, is like S. So that's why we don't call it the S matrix. Okay, so this is my last slide. There are many generalizations of this story. In particular, one important set of them is about the punctured S matrix or the defect S matrix, where we study the torus with some singularities. And the definition I gave of pairing manifolds needs to be generalized in that case, because the number of excitations of X and the number of excitations of Y in that case are no longer equal, but there's still a square S matrix. And so, okay, there's some interesting story there. There are other generalizations of S matrix to higher dimensions, which are much more like S matrix. So in particular, Ying Ran and collaborators studied the 3 torus, and which has a modular group, which is SL3Z, and tried to use those modular transformations to characterize topological order in 3 dimensions. But actually T3 is a sort of exception to our story because it's not a pairing manifold. If you can divide T3 in half in 3 ways, into X here is a torus shell, and Y is a torus shell, and Z is a torus shell, but the intersections between any pair of them is not a ball. Instead, it's a I guess it's a solid torus. And so the information about any one of them is distributed amongst the other two. So in this case, there's no one region that braids with all of the excitations of a given one of these. Rather, it's like some kind of, instead of pairing, it's like a three-way kind of relationship. So this requires some new concept. Another very important open question is, I said that our construction of closed manifolds works for any manifold whose tangent bundle is trivial, the Stiefel-Whitney's classes of whose tangent bundle are zero. And so you might wonder whether the rest of the manifolds are hiding some secret information that's crucial for classifying phases of matter. I don't know. There are so many very interesting things about CP2 in particular. Okay, and so then let me just close by restating this big goal, of which we've made some very small progress in a very special case, which is, I think that if someone hands you a density matrix, it should be possible on just a simply connected domain, it should be possible to extract all of the universal data that it contains, not just for liquid topological order phases, but much more generally, right? So, Tharoon and Peter have done some important work on, extracting, the whole Hamiltonian from just a single state, right? I think it's in the same spirit of that kind of enterprise, which I think it's a much more general question, of which these are special examples. Okay, so that's the end. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks, John, for the very nice talk. I guess it's time for questions. So feel free to unmute yourself to ask questions.
Hi, sorry. I have a general question. And it's like in the mathematics, there is this Cobordism hypothesis, which says that a fully extended TQFT is completely determined by, let's say, a category around a defined along a point. So does your story have anything to do with that? Thank you very much.
That's a very interesting question. It certainly has to do with it, but the work of making contact between this story and that one has not been done. I guess part of the reason it hasn't there, I guess there, I can think of two important reasons why it hasn't been done. One is that that Cobordism hypothesis or theorem is proved starting from some set of assumptions, right? There's some axioms that from which that proof begins, and we're starting from a different set of assumptions, from which actually we can hope to prove those axioms, right? So in some sense, we're doing something more machine level, right? We're doing something prior to that work, but then I guess there's a second, and so we haven't proved all of those assumptions, but in particular this one about remote detectability, I think actually is one of them, but then there's a second aspect, which is more of a cultural problem, which is I haven't exactly managed to understand what the theorem says. I always get stuck on the argument about what the target category should be, and that always involves a lot of words that I don't understand. So actually, I'd be very happy to if you would tell me more about it. But yeah, I do think there should be contact between these things.
Thank you very much.
I got a very maybe a vague question, because I was just wondering whether one can say something about the 3D fractal phases, because some fractal model can be understood as in terms of the foliation structure, in terms of to connect it to the 2D topological order, right? So I wonder if you get some data from the 3D order and whether you can say something or bootstrap in the 3D fractal universal data. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to the spirit of this question. I think, well, yeah, so definitely some generalization would be required, because the 3D fracton wave functions definitely violate the axioms, right? At least they violate axiom one in that, well, we know that the information convex set of some region in a Fracton state is not going to be independent of deforming the shape of the region, right? Mm-hmm. In the same way that the number of ground states changes if you add sites.
Right.
And so the isomorphism theorem necessarily must fail. And I think the way that that happens is that A1 is violated. So it would definitely require some relaxation of the story. I guess also more generally, you'd have to think about the information convex set, not just of annuli and balls, but of, you know, therefore you'd have to think about, it would depend on the geometry. So you'd have to think about the information convex set of like fractal regions also.
Right.
I think might be very interesting. your question was about a more limited class of fractal phases that you can build by foliating. And maybe that's a good place to start.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, I think Tarun has a question.
Yeah, maybe I should just, I don't know why I'm asking, but I can just ask in person, but is there, do you see how would something like Carroll center charge enter your picture? I'm sure Bowen has, that's what, I'm sure Bowen has spent a lot of time thinking about it, but is there some way to think about how does the famous formula relating central charge to quantum dimension, how does that, is there some quote unquote, I mean, some derivation of that within the sphere of thinking or?
Yeah, great question. An answer that you know is, you know, from an arbitrary density matrix, you can extract this modular commutator, right?
Right.
So that's sort of in the same spirit.
Right.
But your specific question about the, I guess it's, what is it called? Starts with an M.
Whatever. E to the 2π. Yeah, I don't know the name. But
yeah, that formula for the central charge, right, in terms of a sum over anions, that I would be very excited to know about. So one ingredient in that formula is the topological spin, right? Mm-hmm. It's a sum of over the dimensions times the topological spin, is what extracts the central charge.
Right.
And I didn't mention the topological spin here, but we sort of understand something about the topological spin, and it's related to the fact that an annulus can be immersed in the ball in two different ways. One way is the usual one, and the other one is as a figure eight.
Mm-hmm.
So the figure eight, you know, think about it like a flat figure eight, is an annulus immersed non-trivially in the ball. And the information convex set, starting from the information convex set of the figure eight, we can extract the topological spin. But there's a very important step that we haven't completed, which is to prove that there exists a reference state on the figure eight. If we can do that, we understand the topological spin. And so that's a sort of starting point for answering your question. The shorter answer to which is I don't know. Yeah. But I expect it's possible. Yeah.
Maybe on a related note, we know at least just from very naive TQFT picture that there's no notion of chiral spaces in 3+1D, right? There's nothing like a standard John-Simons term. You have to always come to like BF term or something. But is there
anything at least.
Right, but is there some hint from, because here you're not assuming anything, right? You're just going and there's no field here, there's nothing. You're just starting from more, I would say, primitive assumption. So then is there some sense you see this distinction between 2+1D and 3+1D of something being not chiral, like things don't exist in 3+1D, or just some, maybe they, I don't know. Is there some hint for, or in general, even versus odd dimensions, let's say, is there, or odd four dimensions, something like that, like the fact, that sticks with like two and
there should be some mod four thing, but actually there is already some evidence for a mod two thing, which is so, and it's actually exactly related to these manifolds that we can't build by this procedure. Mm-hmm. So
because I saw that something about, for example, you mentioned that when you can define the S matrix in the usual way in 4D, not in 3D, using this, and the pairing manifold of T4 is, you can do, yeah.
Not T4, S2 times S2.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, there's a sense in which the modular commutator is a non-zero modular commutator is an obstruction to putting a wave function on RP2.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have chiral edge modes, there's no orientation reversal symmetry, mm-hmm. and one way to think about it is you can't make it by orbifolding, right? By like gluing the thing to itself with an orientation mm-hmm. reversing transformation. And that's related to the fact that W1 of RP2 is non-zero, right? It's not orientable.
Mm-hmm.
There should be a similar thing in four dimensions, which detects the obstruction to having a spin structure to W2 non-zero.
Mm-hmm. I see.
I don't know what it is yet. I guess right. So it's not as simple as something chiral, right? Because it should be even under right. parity. Mm-hmm. In six dimensions, in 6+1 dimensions, I expect that there should be something similar to the modular commutator, yeah, mm-hmm. which detects the parity mm-hmm. violation. But yeah, I think you're right that in odd space dimensions there isn't such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
At least in 3+1 dimensions there isn't such a thing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Do we have any other questions? Yeah, if not, then let's thank John again for the nice talk. Yeah, and I'll stop recording.